Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Good morning. Frederick.
Present.
Frankie.
Present.
Backer.
Backer present.
Baker. Excused. Becker Finn.
Present.
Hansen.
Present.
Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Lippert.
Present.
Moeller.
Present.
Pearson. Pearson. Thompson.
Present.
Pearson. I think he's still getting back in here. A quorum is present.
Okay. Thank you. We have quorum. Our next item is on the agenda is approval of the minutes from last Wednesday, January 20th. The minutes were included in the hearing documents emailed to all by the committee staff. Are there any questions or comments on the minutes? If not, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
So moved.
Okay. Representative Mueller moves approval of the minutes for January 20th, 2021. Please unmute yourself for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, our main topic today is to discuss the challenges facing our states.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Pearson. I am present and my Bluetooth device wasn't working. I apologize.
Okay, let the minutes notes reflect that Representative Pearson is here. Thank you for clarifying that, sir. We appreciate it. As we will hear from our presenters, the total capacity of inpatient beds in Minnesota is inadequate, and the distribution of those beds across geography and systems is inequitable. Both of these problems present major challenges to patients and providers. As we've already been told this month, and we will hear again today, inpatient beds only reflect the most severe end of the continuum of care for behavioral health services needed in Minnesota. But if our capacity to handle patients experiencing crisis is overrun, that shortage creates the most dire consequences for our entire state. Today, we will hear stories about what it's like to wait for days in an emergency department to gain access to appropriate care. We'll hear stories from frontline healthcare workers about what's happening when patients aren't receiving adequate treatment. And we'll hear stories similar to the one that Representative Backer shared with us the other week about having to transport patients all the way across the state just to find an open bed. Since being asked to chair this committee, one of the largest concerns I've heard from all across the behavioral health community is the uncertainty surrounding St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul, which recently shuttered its emergency department and is not committed to continuing the presence of its 100 behavioral health beds beyond this calendar year. To be clear, this hearing is not just about St. Joe's. Our challenges on this topic are statewide and cannot be reduced to the choices of one hospital or one provider system, but the ripple effect that would arise from losing such a significant portion of our state's overall capacity in one blow would loom large in this conversation. I have invited representatives from Enview Health and St. Joseph's to participate in today's hearing, and they've chosen to submit a written testimony instead. This has been sent out and it is posted. There are a few lines that I do want to make sure that are emphasized out here from their letter. They do say that at this time, they have no plans to close the mental health beds located at St. Joseph's campus. However, there is a stark financial reality that we are facing as we continue to support inpatient services well beyond the needs of our attributed patient population. Besides the letter from NHealth Fairview, there are a number of other letters that were part of the material sent to members last night, and these are also posted online. Before we begin the hearing from testifiers who have chosen to share their time and thoughts with us today, I want to share a few goals for this conversation. One, we want to understand the current distribution of behavioral health inpatient beds in Minnesota. total beds, geographical distribution by system, facility, average occupancy, et cetera. Also to understand the consequences of our current bed infrastructure from as many perspectives as possible, and to solicit recommendations for how to reduce demand on our inpatient patient network through upstream solutions, as well how to stabilize and bolster our current bed capacity. We do have a long list of testifiers today, and I've asked everyone to limit their opening remarks to 3 minutes, with the exception of the first two speakers who will provide us with some background data on this topic. We will take occasional pauses to take questions from members, but if we get behind the schedule, I may choose to let the remaining testifiers to speak before coming back to questions and discussions. With that, I'd like to move to our first speakers, Stefan Gildemeister from the Department of Health, to provide us with some background data about our status on our status quo bed infrastructure. Stefan Gildemeister, if you could identify yourself, who you're with, and please start your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. While I bring up my slides, I will introduce myself. I'm Stefan Gildemeister, I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health, and am the state health economist. And in that role, we look to bring data and evidence and analysis to the Minnesota legislature on relevant topics. May I ask if you can see the slide deck?
We can.
Excellent. So I have 10 minutes for I think what is a really complex and sometimes confusing story. I will limit myself to the issues that you asked me to focus on, which essentially is some detail on the regulatory approach, and then sharing with you some data on bed capacity. We can, of course, cut and slice the data further and also help longer term with thinking through what is known about mental illness in the state and what services are being used or available geographically. I've shown a reference here to a report that we did in 2007, which is generally about questions related to investments in medical facilities. It appears a little outdated, but many of the key questions that we're addressing in it about the challenges are, I think, still relevant, and I'm drawing on it for...
Excuse me, Mr. Gildemeister, could you enter the slideshow presentation part of your PowerPoint there? We're seeing all the side the slides on the side there. It should be something you should be able to hit to get it started.
Yeah, I have two monitors. Is this better?
Yes, it is.
Excellent. So just to jump in, given how much time we have, more generally, to the question about how Minnesota regulates hospitals and why, the state really regulates hospitals to ensure that they have the required training, knowledge, experience, physical environment, and services necessary to protect life, safety, and welfare of the public. A good share of what we do at the health department in that role is done under contract with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to certify that hospitals meet the requirement under CMS requirements to deliver services to beneficiaries of the Medicare program. So as part of that, we conduct audits and perform validation surveys. We take in complaints, recertify hospitals, as I noted, about compliance with CMS requirements, and then also process licensures of hospitals annually and payments for these licenses. One question was sort of what role does the state have in regulating closures, and as far as I can tell, there aren't really state laws that where either MDH or other entities have a role in regulating business activities. In other words, what services are delivered or at what volumes. There's one reference to closures and curtailing of services, and that relates solely to circumstances where patients have to be moved between facilities or relocated. But so we tend to be, so to speak, in the business of ensuring that the capacity meets the requirement, is consistent with laws. And then, and this is my next point, we regulate expansion of capacities. So currently Minnesota operates under a hospital bed moratorium with a process to request exceptions to the moratorium. That's the public interest review that I'll say a few more words about in a moment. Leading up to the establishment of the hospital moratorium, Minnesota was concerned about overcapacity of beds, licensed beds in the state, and sort of the concern about costs associated with excessive inpatient capacity, meaning more beds, more hospitalizations, longer hospitalizations. And the moratorium was sort of a response to the previous certificate of need law that was seen to not really play an effective role in controlling growth in medical facilities and healthcare investments. Really at a high level, the moratorium law prohibits the establishment of new hospital licenses, meaning new hospitals, and also the expansion of existing hospital license beds. And then in 2004, the legislature established a process to help it be informed in its deliberations as it considers exceptions to the moratorium. So there is a freeze on hospital beds in place, but there is the ability to obtain exceptions, and there's a process to help inform the legislature on that. I popped this into a little bit of a timeline to give you an appreciation of this storyline. So through the hospital moratorium was established in 1984. Prior to that, Minnesota had a certificate of need law, which was essentially a process to argue in favor of the establishment of a new of new hospitals, and apparently it was a process that did not result in much scrutiny or slowing of investment. So between 1984 and 2004, expansion of beds took place through 16 exceptions, some of which related to earlier exception granted under the certificate of need law, and the addition of about 94 licensed beds. But that was a process that was essentially just a process where a proposal sort of lobbied the legislature to grant to be granted an exception. 2004, then the public interest review process sought to evaluate evidence on whether a proposal was in the public interest. And since 2004, there was 12 exceptions added to the law, up to 7 public interest reviews were conducted, and 523 additional beds, licensed beds, were permitted under the moratorium. And I have more data both on the projects and the process. Overall, I want to say that though there is this addition of licensed beds, that addition of licensed beds occurred in Minnesota, the overall bed capacity has declined modestly over time. So a few words on the public interest review process. So as I said, it's really intended to give policymakers evidence about the merit of a proposal and context in which that proposal exists. So we are to look at a number of relevant factors related to access to staffing, access to support for uncompensated care, effect on other hospitals, and really to what extent a proposal is perceived necessary to deliver timely and high quality care in Minnesota or to improve it. The process consists of a submission of proposals by an applicant, a health system, or an operator. Then we at the health department take an empirical approach to reviewing the proposals so that we conduct our own market analysis to assess whether the proposed beds are really consistent with the need for beds, we conduct interviews, we obtain public input, and then we write a report that we submit to the legislature with a determination that expresses our opinion on whether the proposal is in the public interest. The legislature retains the decision-making authority. Here's sort of a quick...
Mr. Gildmeister, if you could speed things up just a little bit here, because we've got a lot of other people that we're going to try to hear from.
Okay, then I will skip a few slides. I will pause here for a second to let you know that in our process of conducting the public interest reviews, we've noted a number of shortcomings, and I list them here on this slide deck. You wanted us to reflect on bed capacity, and that's what I'm doing in the next couple of slides. So one of the shortcomings, or one of the facts of the moratorium, is that it essentially froze in place the bed capacity that existed when the moratorium was passed. And what that meant is facilities who had a lot of unused licensed beds kept them on. We refer to them sometimes as banked beds. And these banked beds are associated with systems in urban areas, most significantly, but not exclusively. And here on the right hand, so you see a distribution across the state on the left hand side with a little focus on the Twin Cities. And then on the right hand side, you see individual hospitals with banked beds. So to summarize what you're seeing on the right, Fairview and Mayo are the two largest systems by the measure of banked beds that they have, 1,400 and about 1,100 beds respectively. I mentioned that licensed and available beds have modestly fallen over time. And then you also asked us to provide you with some basic data on where mental health bed capacity is and capacity on substance use disorder. And that's by system shown here in this slide. The top quadrant of this table shows you sort of the private nonprofit hospitals in the state, some affiliates, some not, and then in a line below, you see hospitals operated by the Department of Human Services. Most of the mental health beds are located in urban areas, and they're affiliated with the large systems. And that is also true with chemical dependency beds, or actually it's not most, it is all beds. I should say these are data that are reported to the health department, and it may vary through sort of standard reporting, and it may very well be that there are differences between what is sort of put in annual reports and what this looks like on the ground. Most of mental health visits, though, occur in hospitals that have dedicated psychiatric units, more than 95%. And I'll end there and stand for questions if that's helpful.
Okay, thank you. I see Representative Becker Finn has a question. Representative Becker Finn, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was noticing on that map, I think it was your slide 14, the biggest gap to me looks like it corresponds with where our largest tribal populations are. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, the interplay between MDH and IHS and, how we are able to serve those folks who live, specifically I'm looking like Beltrami County area, it looks like the biggest gap and where those dots are on your map coincides pretty closely with Leech Lake, White Earth, and Red Lake. So just wondering if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have to thank you for the question. I have to clarify what this map is showing. So this is not the location of licensed beds or mental health beds. It is just representing the location of hospitals that have unused bed capacity. So all this is showing is where hospitals have available beds that are lower than their licensed beds. Nevertheless, I think your question is a good one, and it's a complex one to answer about the interplay between tribal services and the delivery of healthcare services to residents in Indian country. I don't know that I can do it justice just responding to it in a few seconds, but essentially tribal members would have the ability to go to hospitals outside of the IHS services, but also within sort of IHS services. But I think maybe the better thing to do for me is to share a map with you that shows where hospital beds are, and we can do that for mental health beds separately, so that you have a sense, a better sense of the geographic distribution. It's likely still consistent with what you said, where there are fewer services available to people living on reservations.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead, Representative Beckerman. We've got two more, and then I'm going to have to push on because we are starting to fall behind on time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you, the presenter, for clarifying that. And I, you know, just want to make the point. Either way, as you note, there's a gap there in the available beds. So would appreciate some follow up. I'm sure other members of the committee would as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. I will go to Representative Lippert. Then after that, I'll have Representative Frankie, and then we'll continue with the next presenter, Representative Lippert. If you have a quick question, then please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Gildemeyer, thank you so much. I'm curious if you have an idea of how other states provide some oversight of beds or ensure appropriate distribution of beds. Is Minnesota system common, or is it unusual? Do you have an idea of what some other states do, or are there good models for what other states do?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert, there is a spectrum, and I think the spectrum represents regulatory philosophy and sort of how states wish to deal with this health policy issue. And the spectrum really goes all the way from closely regulating and planning hospital bed capacity to really entirely letting the private market self-regulate. I don't know that that I have a good sense of what is a good system, and as I indicated, it's really a question of what you want to accomplish. If you want the private market to sort of be the primary disciplining factor, then no regulation works, but there is going to be a lot of tension and friction and cost related to that process working out, and probably a maldistribution where rural areas services for low income individuals will not adequately be served. So again, I'm sorry, this is my second answer, the same answer to your second question. It's a really complex question, and I think it may deserve further discussion. I hope that's a helpful response.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. I will move on to Representative Frankie, and then after his question and quick answer, we will be going on to our next presenter. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and be brief. Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister, for your presentation. Am I to understand that this initial part of the presentation is about all medical bed capacities, so not necessarily mental health? And then the last slide pertains to what the capacity is for mental health and chemical dependency beds.
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's okay. So if I hopscotch a little bit between topics, I think it's because those are the questions that I was asked to address. But yes, one thing I would add to that is to say, mental health beds are not a separate license category under state and federal law. So we don't license mental health beds. We license beds, and generally it's up then to facilities to choose how to allocate them and how to operate them. There are some provisions around if you have mental health beds, how they need to be operated, architectural requirements, etc. But sort of the licensing of psychiatric capacity is not a separate aspect of oversight of hospital capacity.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Thank you, Mr. Franke. At this point in time, we'll move on to Dr. Michael Trangle. If you could please introduce yourself, who you're with, and start your presentation, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Michael Trangle. I'm here representing the Minnesota Psychiatric Association. And what I hope to do in this talk is, you guys are already past sort of what I view as sort of like, is it a devil or an angel? I.e., do we need more inpatient psych beds or more intermediate resources? You guys are clearly sophisticated enough and you're sort of saying, what do we need to do to prevent mental illness and substance use problems from getting worse? If it becomes a crisis, what's available? How do you get them into inpatient units? This slice I'm going to be talking about here is once they're on an inpatient unit, how can we get them out as soon as they're ready to get out of that hospital bed, which is the most expensive category, and into majority of the people that we're focusing on. Some can go home, but many, many of them are not safe to go home and they need to go to group homes or residential treatment centers or CD places, intermediate resources. This is a study from May of 2017 that was done by the Minnesota Hospital Association as well as Wilder. And it gives you, and this is something we've done most intensively in the East Metro, meaning Ramsey County, Washington County, and Dakota County, but a way to actually scientifically figure out how and how many, what beds you need and what and the numbers you need to get the flow going. So we looked at 20 hospitals throughout the state. Thank you for switching the slide. If you think about, I'm a patient, I'm in one bed for one whole day, that's considered a bed day. So this study looked at basically a snippet of time where there were 32,520 bed days involved. When we looked at that, we saw that 6,052 of them, those beds were filled for that day with psych patients who did not need a hospital level of care, but were not safe to go home, and they needed to go to other places. And had those other places had availability right then and there, we could have gotten another patient who's waiting in the ED into the hospital bed that day. And basically, if the flow was dammed up, we could have unstuck, at least put a hole in that dam and get some of them to keep flowing through. Next slide, please. So one-fifth of the beds, essentially, people did not need that level of care. If we looked at, this is statewide, and I really only chose to show statewide data. We have more discrete data for the East Metro. But the main things that were not available, one was the state-run community behavioral health hospitals, the 16-bed units that are throughout the state. 14% of patients were waiting to get into a bed there. 11% of the patients were waiting to get into a chemical dependency treatment bed, a facility that had a bed and couldn't get in. Another 10% of people were waiting to get into an IRTS or an intensive residential treatment service bed. And then another 8% were waiting because they were in the middle of a commitment proceeding. They were waiting to get a CADI waiver so that someone would pay for them to go to a group home. Next slide, please. And it's really not that difficult to figure it out. We got data from DHS to show that that year, if you looked at an IRTS bed, the average for that one bed, 5.5 patients could cycle through that bed in the course of a year. If you take that, you can plug it into a formula and figure out, next slide, please, how many IRTS beds you needed statewide, at least according to the sample, which didn't include every bed in every psych bed in the state. But you could see that, at least from this sample, and we tend to think about, when we did the study, we thought about them in terms of a catchment area. So if I would be in Duluth and St. Mary's or something, in that catchment area, of those two hospitals that have psych beds up there, we would need X number of IRTS beds to meet that need. And this is done statewide, but we have more discrete data by regions. So we needed more, 72 more IRT beds. Anoka State Hospital was also a recipient of patients from, you know, if you think about how things have played out, these days, most everybody that needs an inpatient psych bed gets into a community or a private inpatient psych bed. You don't directly get into Anoka. You can get into the 16-bed CBHH units if you're in greater Minnesota. So of the people that were in these community psych beds, we needed 70 more Anoka State Hospital beds to meet the need. For chemical dependency treatment facilities with beds, we needed 54 more beds. We needed 46 more beds at the community behavioral health hospitals, and we needed 24 more group home beds. Next slide, please. So just I want to tell you, this snippet that we looked at isn't studying, but it's certainly possible to measure and do the same thing for how many more inpatient psych beds do we need. You know, this doesn't reflect that, but there are ways to figure out if you look at number of people waiting to get transferred to a psych bed from med-surg or ICU units, waiting in EDs or waiting in other places, it might be jails, to get into a psych bed. It's possible to calculate the number of inpatient psych beds you need. This study doesn't focus on that, but it's eminently doable. Next slide, please. This is more sort of the, since it was a study and we want to be scientific, some of the caveats, basically they boil down to saying it doesn't reflect the full year. It's an underestimate, but it's a start. And it certainly underrepresents the need for AMRTCs because we didn't get an accurate count from jails. Next slide, please. Please don't think of it, do we need more inpatient psych beds or more intermediate resources? The reality is we need both. We can, if we do a study, we can measure the number of inpatient beds we need. We can, in some sense, easily measure how many of the intermediate beds we need, and we can measure that flow. What I'm suggesting is instead of what Minnesota has been doing, if you think about it, I'm a very poor house repair guy, carpenter. And I know there's an old adage, you know, measure twice, cut once. I think Minnesota has been cutting all the time and not measuring at all. And then we find ourselves in a mess trying to figure out how to get out of that mess. And we don't need to. If we devoted some resources to periodically measuring how many inpatient psych beds do we need, how many intermediate beds do we need, we could at least take a guess, and then if we did it periodically, we need to grow the intermediate beds. Once they truly meet the need, it's probably going to be likely to figure out whether we can safely and how much we can shrink the more expensive inpatient beds, but only if we measure it. Minnesota has gone through three or four cycles where we say we're going to build more intermediate resources, but what we've done is cut inpatient beds and not done the intermediate resources, as we've gotten into more dire and more dire straits. I'm just suggesting, let's do it scientifically, let's put resources into periodically measuring it and knowing where we stand and what we really need. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trangle. Appreciate the presentation. Representative Mueller, you have your hand up. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Dr. Trangle, if this study is related to adults and children. I'm just curious about where children fit into the picture here.
This particular one was adults only.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Dr. Trangle. I couldn't hear that.
Mr. Chair, committee member, this particular one was adults only, but it's certainly doable for kids. We just didn't do it in this one.
Any other questions for Dr. Trangle right now? Seeing none, thank you, Dr. Trangle, for your presentation. Appreciate it. We will now start taking testimony from our people who have signed up. I want to remind folks that we have approximately 3 minutes for each of your presentations. And the first person I have is Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI. If you could introduce yourself and who you're with, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. If you or a loved one was having a heart attack, would you worry that there wouldn't be an open bed in the cardiac unit? No, you wouldn't. You only worry about an open bed when you have a mental illness. The discrimination that children and adults face in accessing mental health care is great. and not being able to access care leads to poor outcomes, such as people dropping out of school, becoming unemployed, ending up homeless or in jail, or dying by suicide. The crisis in our mental health system is going to increase as more Minnesotans struggle with their mental health during the pandemic, as those with serious mental illnesses experience an increase in their symptoms, and as we lose 16% of our inpatient beds in the metro area. In the letter I submitted, I outlined the need to build our community mental health system so we do what we can to prevent people from needing to enter the front door of a hospital and to help them discharge safely out the back door. But when you need hospital level of care, you should not have to wait for 4 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours or for days. You should not have to travel to North Dakota from Minneapolis for an open bed. You should not leave the ER without treatment, and you should not be discharged to the streets. There are many unused hospital beds in Minnesota, and so today hospitals could add beds without going through the public review process. So why aren't they when there's clearly a need? Money. Medicaid and Medicare pay less than the cost for inpatient mental health care, typically a loss of thousands of dollars per patient. So health systems don't want to add beds, even when they promise to, for example, at the Maple Grove Hospital. Despite the fact that all hospitals lose money on inpatient psych, only one plans to close beds. MHealth Fairview has already closed 18 psych beds at Southdale, and the 110 beds at St. Joe's will close by the end of the year. There are typically over 1,800 inpatient psych admissions every year at St. Joe's. There is not a viable plan to replace those beds. Any plan must integrate mental health and health care, have an emergency room, and be able to bill Medicaid. A psych-only hospital will fail on all counts. Some health systems state that they have the capacity to meet the patients in their systems, but many people who are poor, and particularly people from BIPOC communities, don't have a primary care physician, so their needs are not being factored into these plans. Every year, NAMI and the Mental Health Legislative Network come to the Capitol with recommendations for how to continue to build the mental health system. You have a significant role to play to increasing funding and creating better policies, but others have a role to play too. Hospitals and healthcare systems are required to assess and meet the needs of the community, and they need to add more beds and not close beds. Health plans must start paying for the very community services that address the front and back door issues, especially IRTS facilities and psychiatric residential treatment facilities, and they need to begin to finally following mental health and substance use parity laws. I urge you, on behalf of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families, to not sit back and watch this crisis unfold, but to take steps to avert it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Next, we will go to Janelle Zern. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Good morning. My name is Janelle Zarn, and 2 weeks ago, our 15-year-old daughter, who we adopted from foster care when she was 12, and who has diagnoses of reactive attachment disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, complex PTSD, ADHD, generalized anxiety disorder, and generalized depressive disorder, had a mental health crisis. At the beginning of what turned out to be a three-hour rage, we called our local regional crisis home only to find out that crisis homes in Minnesota do not serve children or youth. They also weren't knowledgeable at all about the children's mental health system. Then we called the police, who could also do little but talk to her and reassure us. We ended up calling the police two more times that night. We made the last call right after my husband had to restrain our daughter to stop her from physically assaulting him. And in the course of the restraint, caught sight of her arms covered in self-harm slashes from wrist to elbow. This meant she was now a danger to herself, so the police could finally do something. They called an ambulance, which transported our daughter to the ER, where finally she would get some real help. And then we waited, and we waited, and we waited. We waited for over 24 hours to find an open inpatient psychiatric bed for her. The first two places they called were full, and the facility that was able to finally take her is almost 70 miles from our house. We considered ourselves lucky, though, because there are families in our area we know whose children had to be sent to Fargo 4.5 hours away because there were no other open beds. I'm sure that you hear these stories all the time from parents in very rural areas, but the thing is, we don't live in a rural area or a frontier area. We live 10 miles north of Mankato, a city of almost 60,000 with two colleges and a level 3 trauma center. And it's not just beds that aren't available. We have to drive 90 miles to Rochester to access a pediatric psychiatrist who doesn't have an 8-month wait for appointments. It shouldn't be this hard to access the professional care she needs close to home, and we shouldn't have to wait long hours in an ER for a psychiatric bed or travel to North Dakota for a bed. I can't tell you how heartbreaking it was to watch our daughter languish in an ER bed waiting for the help she so desperately needed because of the lack of adequate public mental health care options in Minnesota. Please do something, because our children deserve better than to languish. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zarn, for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it, and we hope for the continued improvement for your daughter. Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Catherine Ford. Ms. Catherine Ford, I'd like to introduce herself and start, please. Ms. Ford, you are on mute. That's all right.
Sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Catherine Ford. I'm 20 years old and I live in Duluth, Minnesota. Last spring, I experienced my first manic episode. Staff at my college reached out to Birch Tree, a mental health crisis program, and they believed that I might need inpatient care and wanted to clear me medically, so they brought me to the ER. That was about noon. This was all new to me, and as we arrived, hospital staff grabbed my arms and brought me to a room. The crisis team left without anyone telling me what was going on. I told them that I was willing to get treatment, but before and while waiting, I decided I'd changed my mind and wanted to leave. Later, a doctor came in and told me that I was going to be placed on a 72-hour hold and admitted to the inpatient psychiatric unit. But I worked at this hospital, and I was nervous that coworkers could violate my HIPAA rights, so I decided to transfer to another hospital. But there were no beds. In all of Minnesota, there were no beds. At midnight, they told me that they were going to send me to Fargo, North Dakota, and that I would be there for about a week. Fargo was 242 miles, or 4.5 hours away from my home. They held me in the hospital overnight, and with the plan of transferring me in the morning. I was alone in the ER that night. No one had notified my parents, and no one knew I was there. I was scared. They gave me a dose of Ativan, a fast-acting anti-anxiety medication that doesn't last very long. In the morning, an oncoming ER doctor decided I couldn't be manic because I slept during the night and decided to discharge me with no referral, no information, and no discharge plan. I'd actually not slept at all that night and was indeed very manic when I left the hospital lobby alone that morning. I spent 20 hours in the hospital ER and didn't receive any mental health care. I left without a prescription, without seeing any mental health professionals, and without a discharge plan to know what to do next. If it weren't for my parents and a very dedicated college counselor, I would be navigating my first major mental health crisis completely alone. The consequences of this could have been disastrous. We need more psychiatric beds, not less. People shouldn't have to be shipped hundreds of miles from home just for a few nights of basic psychiatric care. Even worse is receiving no care at all due to the lack of beds. Mental health can be a matter of life and death, and we need to have beds available to save lives. Closing the St. Joseph inpatient psychiatric unit will only devastate our already overwhelmed mental health system, and we need to do better. I had someone to help me after our mental health system failed me, but many are not so lucky.
Thank you, Ms. Ford, for sharing your story with us, and wish you continued recovery and good luck going forward. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have Paul Goering. If you'd like to introduce yourself, Paul, and start your testimony, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you both for allowing my testimony and agreeing to staff this important committee. My name is Paul Goering, and I'm speaking as a community member. I'm a psychiatrist, and I've spent my career focusing on issues of access, quality, and value in behavioral health, both as I previously led Allina Health's behavioral health enterprise and in national and state work groups. My comments this morning were crafted with the intent of supporting this committee in its new work. While these issues are complicated, I would like to suggest a simple model that I use, and I hope you will find that it serves you with the issues that come before this committee, whether beds or any other service. The model is that of COVID care. Sadly, we've all come to know the three pillars of COVID care all too well. Prevention, how do I avoid getting it? Early intervention, what do I do if I get sick so it doesn't get too bad? And hospital care, if I get really sick, will it be there for me? An ICU, a ventilator? And as mentioned at the onset of the call today, there's great wisdom in organizing prevention and early intervention, as hospital care is the most expensive and complicated. However, each of us hopes hospital care is available when we need it. This COVID model works beautifully for behavioral health too. And using it, here's what we know today. Prevention has great hope, and it's maturing quickly with digital and self-help tools and renewed focus on wellness, yet it remains quite immature. Early intervention, this is really about clinic access. And at current wait times are still commonly measured in weeks and months, and that's in the portion of the state where it's available. Best practice is same-day access, and regrettably, COVID-related mental health conditions will double clinic demand now. Finally, hospital care is about beds, as you know, and there are really two measures of adequacy here. One, occupancy rate of mental health beds, and two, ED wait times when mental health beds are not available. At current, we regularly experience full occupancy and prolonged ED waits. With this, let me offer two specific thoughts related to mental health beds. The first, ideally, one can imagine a time when fewer beds are going to be needed as prevention and early intervention services become mature and reliable. However, now's not such a time. Performance metrics in all three of the pillars currently are falling behind. This makes the potential of losing beds quite anxiety provoking. If we use the COVID model for just a moment, can you imagine the impact of losing 100 ventilator beds if we were already seeing lines of patients backing up? The second specific thought, this challenge is not at all new. In 2007, under very similar circumstances, the Minnesota Medical Association commissioned a panel to look at the issue of beds and mental health beds in Minnesota. The outcome was a recommendation to add 100 mental health beds annually until such a time that mental health wait times were reduced to that of medicine or surgery patients. My hope today was to share a model for your collective discernment as you help our state's system of care, whether it's related to adding new resources or removing barriers. And as evidenced this morning, our community is filled with rich and generous resources.
Mr. Gorey,
feel free to call us for help. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Goring. Next person I have is Ms. Linda Stenstadvold. If you could introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Chair Fisher and members of the Minnesota Behavioral Health Policy Division, my name is Linda Stenstadvold, and I work at Touchstone Mental Health as the director of an ERTS program, which provides 90 days of intensive residential treatment, as well as a crisis program, which provides up to 10 days of residential crisis services to individuals with a mental illness. Touchstone Mental Health is an organization that provides a spectrum of community-based mental health services, such as intensive residential treatment, case management, housing support, and permanent supportive housing for adults with diagnosis of mental illness. We provide services throughout the metro area, as well as to clients seeking our services from Greater Minnesota. Touchstone serves over 2,000 people a year and is a member of the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to briefly speak today from a mental health service provider perspective about the issue of Minnesota's limited mental health inpatient bed capacity. There are countless members of Minnesota's mental health services and advocacy community who have worked very hard for many years to continue to improve upon the spectrum of mental health services available to Minnesotans. In many areas, we have made great progress, but there also remains many areas where more work is needed. Addressing the lack of mental health inpatient bed capacity is one of those areas. At Touchstone, we serve clients experiencing symptoms such as suicidal ideation, mood swings, anger, impulsivity, hopelessness, fear, and paranoia. In addition, many individuals have a dual diagnosis and struggle with substance use issues, in addition to accompanying many medical issues. Homelessness is common among our clients. There are times our clients need a higher level of care for medication management and severe crisis stabilization for short periods of time during their 90-day ERTS residential treatment stay with us, or when they are staying with us for crisis services. Here are some of the impacts we see on the individuals we serve resulting from the shortage of mental health inpatient beds. With the shortage of inpatient psychiatric beds, our clients can spend long hours in emergency departments and even staying overnight waiting for an inpatient psychiatric bed. As hospitals work to keep the client flow moving, opening their beds for greater needs of other clients, clients are often being discharged still needing significant stabilization of medication and mental health symptoms. These higher acuity complex clients create a challenge to our program. We often need to increase staff to ensure a secure, safe environment for all, which ultimately increases our program costs. This higher acuity also causes distractions and stressors to the other clients in our program as they work towards their individual recovery.
If we could, I'm sorry to interrupt, we're at the 3-minute mark. If you could wrap it up, please.
Sure. Also, if we have clients that have aggressive or sex or self-injurious behaviors that pose a risk, we often need to look at law enforcement to help us with that from the legal perspective when we're needing the mental health beds. Solutions, increase the number of inpatient mental health beds, fund the ERTS programs at a rate that would allow us to better serve the clients with this greater need, increase community crisis response teams' ability to assist law enforcement to address the needs, and invest in early intervention mental health services. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Stenstansville. Next, we will have Mr. Brian Zerbes, and I will just give a heads up. I will let our testifiers know when we're at about a 30 second left in the 3-minute thing, so you can kind of adjust your comments if need be. And Mr. Zerbes, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Brian Zerbes, I'm here representing March as a co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee. I also work with North Star Behavioral Health, a substance disorder provider organization. I'm here to talk about and provide input from substance disorders perspective. As of yesterday, Department of Human Services licensing lookup shows that there are 111 residential substance disorder programs in the state that have a bed capacity of 3,680 beds. In a recent March survey, 17 respondents responded to their bed capacity in current census. Those providers represent 2,315 beds, which is 65% of the statewide capacity. And their response rate on their census was at 65%, meaning that across the March respondents, there are nearly 1,200 open beds for substance disorder programs throughout the state. Detox and withdrawal management providers that responded indicated that they were operating at a 50% census. Why the open beds? Feedback from providers. They're indicating people are more reluctant currently to receive services, particularly due to COVID. People are staying at home and in their community and continuing their addiction. Existing workforce challenges are compounded by COVID. COVID has caused more people to leave treatment early, no-show, avoid coming to treatment. Programs have been quarantining staff, leaving rooms unoccupied to be able to allow for social distancing. Clients are under more stress. There's more mental health acuity in our substance disorder programs. Service gaps have resulted in a serious financial strain for many programs. And a rural provider noted that a significant number of clients that they serve were referred from the court system due to lack of referrals and drug-related offenses. That's causing an impact for that provider. Some key takeaways for substance disorder providers: more beds doesn't necessarily equate to more treatment access. It might just mean making sure that the right treatment access is the key, that people are able to get in. COVID has had and will continue to have an adverse effect on residential programs operations.
30 seconds.
residential programs obviously have 24/7 staffing requirements that result in static costs. Low census for these programs oftentimes mean programs operate at a loss. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to share the experience from substance disorder providers.
Thank you, Mr. Zerbes. Next we have Ms. Julie Bloom. If you'd like to introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Hi, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Bloom, and I'm the CEO at Guild. Guild is a provider of mental health and housing services in the East Metro, and we provide a lot of services in concert and collaboration with St. Joe's in downtown St. Paul. I'm here to talk about the importance of having the entire continuum of services and the impact it can have when you have all of those services in one location. Downtown St. Paul is my home. Living downtown provides me with the opportunity to witness the consequences of our lack of a comprehensive mental health system every single day. Whether it is seeing the growing number of encampments, people living outside, watching people decompensate with mental health system symptoms on the streets without a clear way to help. We see the uncertainty of St. Joseph's Hospital putting increased pressure on an incomplete and strapped behavioral health and housing continuum and infrastructure in Minnesota. We know the state is currently under capacity for inpatient psychiatric beds for our most acutely sick. At Guild, we are proud to have a successful collaborative effort we have participated in with our partners at St. Joe's, Catholic Charities, and Hearth Connection. This collaborative is called Coming Home. The intervention is simple. We have one Guild staff who takes referrals from St. Joe's Mental Health Inpatient Unit when someone is ready to discharge from the unit but doesn't have a place to go, so they are experiencing homelessness. Our staff simply goes to the hospital, connects with the person, gets to know them, learns about their goals, and then when they're ready to discharge, walks them directly two blocks over to the Catholic Charities housing unit to have housing in a special unit for people who are being discharged with medical needs. But it doesn't end there. At Guild, we believe strongly that people deserve permanent supportive housing in the communities of their choice. So this worker connects with the person, maintains them, and helps to build their work on their goals of mental health stability, ensures that they have wraparound services, and then eventually moves them into permanent housing integrated completely into the communities of their choice. This effort is literally dependent on every single person in that collaborative. The fact that we have the shelter three blocks down is critical because my staff love to tell the story of the time they lost someone, literally lost someone as they were walking on the way to the housing facility. So we at Guild just really hope that we can do more in our system to build up not just the inpatient beds, but the comprehensive services that exists to support their effectiveness to have better clinical outcomes and serve our community. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Blum. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Ms. Glenda Schneider. Ms. Schneider, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Glenda Schneider. I'm a registered nurse with mHealth Fairview. However, I work at St. Joe's Hospital. When I started working on the psychiatric unit at St. Joe's Hospital, 4 years ago, the mental health area had undergone a major expansion at the hospital. Inpatient beds were increased from 68 to 105 to accommodate what they felt was a significant need in the community. Here we are today, 4 years later, and it appears that our employer is looking to close the entire facility as soon as the end of this year. And I'm asking you, what has changed? We need to keep our inpatient mental health beds open and available. All we have to do is look at the statistics. With an increased need to due to the pandemic, job losses, long waits for treatment, psychiatric beds repurposed for COVID-19 patients. We on our unit care for patients with a wide variety of mental health issues, schizophrenia, bipolar, psychosis, paranoia, personality disorders, depression, anxiety, suicidal thought, intent, drug and or alcohol addiction withdrawal, eating disorders, cognitive delay, These individuals may also be considered vulnerable adults, require medical care for chronic disease, and may also be experiencing homelessness, financial issues, sexual exploitation. Patients may exhibit uncooperative, irrational, illogical, aggressive behaviors. More often than not, these patients also need medical care while stabilizing their medications, during withdrawal from alcohol or drugs, or attending to chronic issues. Therefore, an inpatient hospital bed is conducive to their recovery. We need to address co-occurring conditions for successful treatment in an effective setting, inpatient beds. Inpatient beds provide specialized, valuable services to this population. We work as a team to handle situations that require de-escalation of patients whose behaviors are not rational or logical through management of medications, multiple therapies, unit activities, and socialization. We are privileged to witness the transformation of these individuals from being unable to function on a personal level, much less in the community, to successful performance of daily living and communicating in society. If we continue to close facilities, where will this population receive necessary care and what will happen to them? I personally have worked with patients that would have possibly followed through with their suicidal plans, homeless patients living on the street and in tents during frigid cold weather, young girls who may have been sexually exploited would
Excuse
not
me,
have
Ms. Schneider?
Yes.
We're at time now.
Okay. Just that these young yep. girls refuge with us is what I wanted to say, and we need to provide that safe haven. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Next, we have Ms. Bernadine Engeldorf. If you'd like to start your presentation, please.
Thank you for providing me with this opportunity to share some of my experience with you. My name is Bernadine Engeldorf. I live in White Bear Township. I am a registered nurse, and for the last 20 years plus of my nursing career, I have worked in the field of mental health and addiction services. My primary place of employment has been at United Hospital. I only say that because I believe there is some relevance of my work location to this discussion. I'm testifying today as I am concerned about the potential reduction of mental health inpatient beds and services in the East Metro. The current climate of mental health in Minnesota is in crisis. A recent study ranks Minnesota as one of the top states in providing care. But with that statement acknowledged, as a nurse in the field, I believe based on our lack of care here in Minnesota, this data demonstrates the true crisis in the United States is experiencing. In fact, our neighbor Wisconsin falls in the bottom, thus noting significant lack of services. Obviously, we know that impacts access in Minnesota. As these residents are having difficulty in Wisconsin, we'll seek care in Minnesota. The lack of access and numbers of inpatient beds and services in Minnesota is evident to frontline care providers. We not only face difficulty admitting individuals to inpatient beds, but we lack outpatient services, as many have told you here. Most individuals enter the inpatient setting through the emergency department. Often this may be directly related to the lack of outpatient services and inability to access care, social stigma, cultural variance, and potentially lack of knowledge related to that access most likely impacts its entrance through the hospital's emergency departments. As we know, our emergency departments are always busy and extremely overwhelmed, especially now with COVID impact. Individuals are waiting for several hours. These individuals may have been able to be seen as an outpatient, but either access is not available or there is long waits of care, or they're waiting due to lack of medical coverage. Many of our emergency departments have specific units, limited number of beds for those seeking mental health. These units are specifically designed to provide assessment, referral, or actual treatment. The nurses have a focus on both physical and mental health care, all ages seeking care in these mental health suites, thus causing additional stress. And those ages are geriatric, adolescent, and adult. They're expected to be assessed and moved into the next level of care. And this level of care in the ED is considered a crisis stabilization. I'd like to quickly share some quotes from nurses and my colleagues in the ED. I feel so terrible. We cannot provide the appropriate level of care. Patients on ED carts.
Ms. Engeldorf, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're at the end there.
Okay, a room with nothing but a TV and isolated from families. Again, the ultimate focus is why are there no beds in the hospital's mental health department? It is necessary for an ongoing evaluation of the status of our mental health addiction services in Minnesota. This not only includes the number of inpatient services, but outpatient as well. It seems so obvious to us, the care providers, especially in the East Metro, that beds not be reduced.
Thank you, Ms. Engeldorf. You're welcome. Next, we have Mr. Buck McAllen. If you could identify yourself and who you're with and start your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and I also represent a group, the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Programs, and I just wanted to comment on Mr. Zerbis's testimony as we're experiencing that exact effect in rural Minnesota about folks not accessing substance abuse care, so I support exactly what he said. But on behalf of the Ambulance Association, this has been a topic that we've talked about for years. It comes up as one of our top issues, whether you're a full-time ambulance service or a volunteer. Still in Minnesota, about 60%+ of ambulance providers are volunteers. They come from their place of work. They come from the welding shop. They come from the farm to staff their ambulances. In 2020, we did nearly 1,000 transports to some of the testifiers today that were patients and care for folks to Fargo, North Dakota. Not sure what Fargo's doing right, but they seem to have capacity for mental health patients especially. These transfers are taking place from Rochester to Fargo, Duluth to Fargo, all over the state. Some of the larger healthcare ambulance systems have the capability to staff for transports like that, but we had a hearing Monday in Chair Liebling's committee on the EMS in crisis and some issues with the ambulance industry across the state. And one of the issues is there's just no way to continue to staff ambulances. So we can't take the gentleman or the lady that works in their small community and put them in an ambulance to do these 6, 7, 8 hour round trip transports. So again, this year, we appreciate the opportunity to talk about the impact. And also I work with the Emergency Physicians Group. That discussions came up today about the ED boarding, and I think everybody knows what the problem is. It's a capacity issue, and we have to have capacity to put patients. So I appreciate the chance to testify today, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Sheriff Chris Kulk. If you'd like to identify yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony, please, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chair, good morning, members. Chris Kulk, Sheriff in Isanti County, Minnesota, in law enforcement for 24 years and also the president of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Two quick stories. One, on behalf of all 87 sheriffs, we are obviously charged by statute to transport individuals that might be in the custody of the courts or jails to mental health facilities throughout the state, especially sometimes for courts. We may be driving across the state to, or even out of state sometimes, to bring people back for 5-minute court hearings. Also, it's when it comes to individuals that are recently arrested, we realize that a lot of these individuals should not be in our jails due to maybe mental health issues, and they should be more in line with some type of a hospital setting while they're waiting for court and going through that process. And we don't have those resources, so they end up staying in jail and not getting the immediate help that they so much need. A personal story where it comes to what all the members are talking to and about availability is about 4 years ago on a July 4th weekend. It was a weekend, and I believe July 4th was on a Saturday. There was a person that was arrested after a domestic assault in a pursuit. They went to the hospital for some injuries. They also needed, the doctors decided they needed mental health treatment. That person was in the Mora Hospital. They are not capable of handling that kind of emergency when it comes to their mental health crisis setup. They found a bed in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Now, we were going to have court on Monday, and now I am charged as sheriff to decide what we should do with that individual. And I will admit I am not a person that I'm not a doctor, so I don't know what this person really needs, but they needed to go to a mental health bed, and however, it was in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Due to the fact that this person was currently looking at charges, we would have actually had to go through an extradition process to bring them back from the state of North Dakota, because we would have taken them out of state and they would have had extradition rights in that state, which would have just prolonged them getting into a facility. So I, as sheriff, made the decision that if Mora Hospital was willing to keep that individual until Monday morning, the courts could maybe have some time to find a facility closer to the Cambridge, Minnesota area. And ultimately they did do that. So that person ended up getting the help that they needed on Monday, which was probably faster than they would have if we would have taken to North Dakota. So again, I do appreciate everybody's time here. Please understand that all sheriffs across the state are transporting these individuals around the state to find beds that generally maybe don't exist, or we're spending a lot of time leaving them in jail for an extra 12 to 24 hours after court in order to get that place where they need to go. So thank you for your opportunity and to consider, you know, keeping beds closer to all of our facilities. Thank you.
You're welcome, Sheriff Kalk. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll be moving to Ramsey County Commissioner Jim McDonough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Fisher, and committee members. Good morning. My name is Jim McDonough, and I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner. I'm pleased to speak with you this morning about the needs of our mental health system. Ramsey County is committed to a holistic mental health system that fully supports the needs of our residents. Whether it's an individual experiencing an episodic or their experiences are severe and persistent, inpatient hospital beds are designed to service clients who are in crisis, similar to an acute case of appendicitis. In order to effectively support Ramsey County residents before and after that crisis point, we need more transitional level services, more housing with supports. It is critical that we support prevention programs that can engage with individuals before they require civil commitment or hospitalization. In addition, we know that residents with mental health challenges do better when they have stable housing supports in place, and there is a need for funding to support these efforts. Ramsey County uses the Adult Mental Health Grant to fund these services and supports. So we are concerned that the proposed DHS budget includes a cut to this program. We need DHS to be strong partners in the continuum of care for people living with mental health and substance use disorders. Issues, for example, the closing of the IRTS at Como was a surprise to Ramsey County, and its closure came at a time when we needed more services, not fewer services. Inpatient hospital beds are a part of a system to address mental health needs, and while it is critical that we have enough beds to serve the needs of our residents, it is important to take a broader scale view of the system as a whole and ensure that services and supports are there to help our residents both before and after they are in need of hospitalization care. In closing, I would like to add that this committee could do a whole meeting on the need for and the issues surrounding children's beds. It's been brought up a couple of times, but the children's beds is even in more crisis than the adult beds. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time and for all the work that you will do to help and support our residents and our community.
Thank you, Commissioner McDonough. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Ms. Tammy Lewick from Crow Wing County. Ms. Lewick, if you'd like to go ahead and identify yourself and start your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Tammy Lewick, and I'm the manager for adult services at Crow Wing County Community Services. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, the Association of Minnesota Counties, AMC, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association, MICA. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today about the reduction in acute inpatient psychiatric beds across our state and the impact this is having on individuals needing this level of care. As counties, we are uniquely positioned to see how the cracks in our behavioral health system are having a crippling effect on the individuals we work with each day. I will echo what others have said as we continue to see numbers of individuals struggling with behavioral health needs increasing during the pandemic. We need to have a strong continuum of mental health care to meet these needs. Inpatient beds are a critical piece of creating this comprehensive support system. Mental health case management cases have increased in Crow Wing County by 27% since last year at this time. Our hospitals continue to have individuals being assessed who need acute inpatient care with no beds readily available. As of yesterday, we had 5 boarders between the ages of 13 and 84 years of age in our local emergency department. Emergency departments are not the right care setting for people experiencing behavioral health crises. It may be safe, yet it does not provide needed treatment. In Greater Minnesota, we faced the closure of Red River Behavioral Health in Grand Forks, North Dakota in July, resulting in the loss of 70 inpatient psychiatric beds. Most often, that facility, as well as Prairie St. John's and Fargo, represent the majority of inpatient beds assessed by hospitals in Region 5. These psychiatric units are over 2.5 hours from our local community. Counties are relying more on other states to provide care for our critically mentally ill individuals, which is a dangerous practice. However, there is nowhere else for them to receive this care. To be honest, one of the ways our region has dealt with the fluctuations in the capacities, whether it be in emergency, outpatient needs, or long-term supports, is through our Adult Mental Health Initiative grants. These grants bring regions together to discuss how to best respond to the acute and long-term services and support needs of our community. Pulling at the threads of this fragile system is very dangerous and leaves so many people in unsafe situations, which will almost assure a more difficult road to healthy recovery and safety. We are greatly disappointed by the governor's budget proposal that contemplates cutting these critical funds. Yet we look forward to working with this committee to outline parameters of strong policies to not only hold on to this fragile system during this pandemic, but also to repair and build it so that we can truly serve struggling individuals with the dignity they deserve. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lewick, for your testimony. Next, we'll move on to Mr. Todd Archibald. If you could please introduce yourself and start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chairman Fisher and members of this committee. I'm Todd Archibald. I'm a social worker and the CEO of Prairie Care, a psychiatric health system based in Brooklyn Park with a hospital for youth. For the last year, we've been watching in horror as hospitals around the world reach capacity with patients with COVID-19. Many of them receive care in ill-equipped medical units, ERs, and even hallways by overworked and exhausted staff. This has been the reality in acute psychiatric care for decades. Being at max capacity is a normal day for us, having to tell other hospitals and ERs that we have no open beds to help their patients. A young patient in one of our outpatient programs ended up in an ER recently after a crisis, which is a common entry point for psychiatric emergencies. This patient was one of 11 other youth in the ER awaiting a psychiatric bed. We routinely admit patients who've been waiting in ERs for days and sometimes weeks. This creates enormous frustration and tension between hospital systems and staff who just want to help their patients. Last year alone, we admitted nearly 1,500 youth transferred to us from other hospitals who did not have capacity to care for them. That's enough kids to fill 27 school buses, yet almost everyone came to us strapped on a gurney in the back of an ambulance. At Prairie Care, we work hard to open 20 psychiatric inpatient beds for youth in 2011 and reach capacity in a month. We expanded to 30, then 50, then 71, and are at capacity still. We estimate there are around 70 practicing child psychiatrists in the state of Minnesota. To put this in perspective, more football players will show up for Viking spring training this year than there are child psychiatrists in the entire state. The problem is not a lack of beds, it's a lack of staff to operate those beds. In healthcare, like everything else in life, you get what you pay for, and we don't pay for mental health. Many hospitals will report that it costs more to provide psychiatric services than are reimbursed by health plans. Several weeks ago, a monumental lawsuit was ruled on, finding one of the nation's most profitable insurance companies was intentionally and methodically denying coverage for psychiatric services. These denials led to kids right here in Minnesota dying as a result of an identified but untreated mental illness. I've personally been working with one local carrier for the last 22 months on expanding in-network coverage. I received a response from them last Tuesday that they're now moving into the credentialing process and they will get back to us in 150 more days. In the time that it'll take us to gain in-network status, I've estimated there will be nearly 400 youth who did not get the psychiatric care they needed when we were able to provide it. In closing, if we pretend for the moment that staffing, parity, and costs were not an issue, then our ideal system would include a much deeper investment into prevention and early identification, including psychologists on every hospital unit, screening in schools, and ongoing access to telehealth. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Archibald, for your testimony. And to our final testifier that we have is Ms. Mary Krinke. If you could identify yourself and who you're representing and start your testimony today, please.
Great. Thank you, Chair Fisher. For the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Minnesota Hospital Association. In 2015, the Minnesota Hospital Association and our members began working proactively with the mental health community to try to improve our mental health services in the state. We reached out to NAMI, we began working with Direct Care and Treatment, our mental health providers, and the Minnesota Association of Mental Health Programs. And I know that mental health has been underfunded for decades here in Minnesota, but I really do feel I would be remiss to not recognize that in the last two sessions, the Minnesota legislature really has put some additional resources into mental health. And for that, we are most grateful. You expanded capacity at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, our community behavioral health hospitals. You put money into mental health innovation grants and into the bonding bill. A lot of people don't realize there was money for the urgent crisis centers in the bonding bill, as well as some housing options for people with persistent mental illness. I do think all of those investments are starting to make a difference, and I want to say our appreciation for that. Before I get into the bed numbers that we were asked to provide, I just want to comment on the comments that other people have made today, and that is about the continuum of care and how important that is. It's about getting services on the front end so that we can avoid hospitalizations and having more discharge options on the back end. I found the study that we had done a couple years ago that Dr. Trangle started out at the beginning of this hearing of how we can move to avoid bed days. That'll free up space in our hospitals for those who need that high level of acute care. So let me get into some of the numbers that the chair had asked us to provide today. So the state operates a direct care and treatment, and they have 100 inpatient beds at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. The state also operates what is called community behavioral health hospitals. There are six of those, and they operate 16 beds each. So that is another 96 beds for our system. Community hospitals, and these are the members of the Minnesota Hospital Association, community hospitals, there are 1,250 mental health and substance abuse beds. Specifically, there are 1,154 beds that are mental health beds, and the remainder are chemical dependency beds. Of that, though, it's important to note that hospitals also provide chemical dependency services in just regular beds, and we had over 11,000 admissions in 2019. There are 836 beds in the metro area, and has been noted, I think one of the crisis areas is inpatient beds for adolescents, and there are only 179 of those beds. I know I'm about out of time, but I do want to mention a couple things upstream. A couple years ago, the legislature passed the Certified Community Behavioral Health Homes Program, Community Behavioral Health Clinics Program, and that is making a big difference because it provides both primary care and mental health services all in one location. Getting to those services out in the community is extremely important. Housing makes a big difference. The ERTS program, it will help us be able to discharge individuals out into the community faster. We need more housing options that can provide mental health services at the same time. My last comment I want to add is on telehealth. During COVID, we have seen a great expansion of telehealth, and it has made a remarkable difference. We are using more mental health providers to provide services to individuals in their homes. This makes access so much more available across the state. I heard throughout the conversation—
Ms. Krinke?
Yeah.
I have to cut you off.
That's okay. I just want to say, urge people to support a telehealth bill that's going to be advancing this legislative session. So thank you all.
You're welcome. Thank you. I want to say thank you, first of all, to all our testifiers. We have a few more minutes here for questions that folks, that people on the committee may have. So if anyone has, anyone on the committee, and I'm seeing hands go up, first of all, I'll go to Representative John Thompson. Representative Thompson, if you'd like to go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Thank you, Chair. I think I missed an opportunity to ask the question about, because I know Bethesda is in our district. What happens to the bank beds now that they're closed at the Bethesda facility? I just wanted to, it was a burning question I wanted to ask. That's it.
Okay, I'm wondering who would be out of our test fires best to answer what happens when beds are banked. Is that somebody from DHS that might be able to help on that?
Mr. Chair, I might recommend Mr. Gildemeister to speak to what happens when beds are put offline.
Mr. Gildemeister, can you address that question? Is when a bed becomes banked, what happens at that point in time? Is it lost forever? How does it come back? What's happening there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So the banked beds represent surge capacity at a given facility to the extent that they can toggle up and down the capacity within their facility. To some extent, the moratorium also permits facilities to move some of those beds between campuses. So it represents an economic interest and a business interest, but also an ability to surge during sort of times when there's great need for beds. These are licensed beds, so they are on the hospital license, they are paid for, but they don't exist as physical capacity. Physical capacities are represented by the number of available beds, which we consider to be beds that are staffed and sort of available without any additional need for construction or physical change.
That appears to have, thank you, Mr. Gildemeister, appears to have answered Representative Thompson's question. Next, I'll go to Representative Jamie Becker-Finn. Representative Becker-Finn, if you'd like to go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to highlight some of the testifiers got to this, but we can build as many ERTS facilities and other options as we want, but if we don't have the licensed staff to take care of people, it doesn't do us any good. And so I would just want to make sure we highlight that because it's an important piece of this puzzle of giving the right level of care and the care that people deserve. So just wanted to make that point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. And then I'm going to go to Representative Frankie, and this will probably be the last question / comment as we're starting to run out of time here. So Representative Frankie, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Not really a question so much. I have a lot of questions here after all these great presenters, and I want to thank everybody for showing up today and telling us their stories and giving us all this information. One thing I want to make sure that we take a look at, Mr. Chair and members, is that it seems to me that these beds have become a commodity to the system, and I personally feel that, you know, we need to get away from that. We're basing everything off of dollars, and we need to base it more on people. So we need to get away from allowing these systems to use these beds as commodity and use them to, the banking of beds for a potential partnership or increase. You know, we need to get away from that. I also want to mention, you know, as Representative Becker-Finn mentioned, you know, it is about the staffing. We can have as many beds in as many places as we want. And I know if Representative Baker was here, he was just telling me the story the other day about how they built this new facility, and it took them a long time to find them the licensed professionals to staff this. They had the beds, they just didn't have the licensed staff. So, you know, overall, I know that I'm committed and we're committed as a committee to, you know, fix this whole issue, but this bed situation, we really need to get away from, we can increase all the beds we want, but we also need the staffing, and we need all of them to be used for the proper purpose. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Frankie. I think you've done a good job of hitting on a number of the issues out there that we're facing. We do have our challenges, and I very much appreciate hearing from all the testifiers from all the different points of view. We do have a lot of work going forward. I would encourage any of the committee members, if you do have questions that you think of afterwards, please forward them on to Committee Administrator Chris McCall, and then we can reach out to get more information. I know that as I've listened to things, I've got more questions that keep on bubbling up in my mind also, but I want to make sure that everyone has this chance to continue these discussions as we go forward. Additionally, I'd like to remind people that if anyone in the public would like to submit testimony, you can still send written testimony to us within the next 24 hours. And then I would like to remind the committee that starting next week, we'll have our first bills available to us, and we will get an agenda out after Thursday's floor session. Once again, thank you everybody for your time. Thank you to all the testifiers. And with that, we are adjourned.